From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hey, I'm glad to be back.
Also in studio with us is Mark Herring. He is Virginia's Attorney General. Mark Herring, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's great to be back. And I think the last couple of times I was here, Jen Golbeck was sitting in for you. So, Jen, if you're out there, we miss you in the studio.
We certainly do, Jen. At a news conference a little while ago, Governor Terry McAuliffe announced that he's restoring voting rights to felons in Virginia. This will allow some 200,000 convicted felons to be registered to vote in November's election in this battleground state. Is this an expansive view of the governor's executive powers, and can the General Assembly counter this with legislation? And what do you think about it?
Well, it's a game changer, really, in the way Virginia has worked with restoration of rights. And the governor's action is, you know, there's ample authority under the state's constitution. Article 5, Section 12 gives the governor these powers. And, you know, reentry is something that is really, really important in Virginia and everywhere. I have worked with reentry programs. We've got a statewide reentry coordinator, and we really, obviously, these are folks who have made a mistake, a serious mistake. They've been convicted of a crime and a felony, but it is the opportunity to get a second chance.
They've served their sentence. This is a key part of this.
That's right. And it might be worth taking a moment and just explain a little bit about the governor's action. First of all, it does not release anyone from prison. It does not expunge any record. But what it does is restore the right of felons who have served their sentences, who have served any period of supervised probation, and allows them to vote, to hold public office, to sit on a jury. And in working with reentry, it is so important that we help those who reenter society and into the community to reenter successfully. We want to help them do it successfully because, number one, it's good for them. And it also helps build safe communities. And I've talked with these folks, and the right to vote is an important part of participating in the community and giving them a second chance and reentering society successfully and participating in democracy.
I know some conservatives will be upset maybe about this, but it's really not that radical. I was looking it up. Something like 38 states in the District of Columbia have a version of automatic renewal. It's not in Virginia. Even Governor McDonald, the Republican governor, a former attorney general in the state, moved to simplify the reentry. And by reentry, we mean people who've been in prison now want to be reentry into society as full citizens.
That's right. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was sitting at the time I was in the state Senate, and at the State of the Commonwealth address, then Governor McDonald made the announcement that he was supporting automatic restoration of rights. And, you know, we all kind of like took a second and think to ourselves, did we actually just hear what we thought we heard? And then about a third of the chamber erupted in applause, myself included, because I've supported automatic restoration of voting rights. The others were a little bit more muted in the chamber.
Well, he's a former prosecutor. I mean, he did know what he was talking about. And it would be so easy right at this moment to make a joke about him facing his own prison sentence. That was a misdemeanor. That's not a felony, right?
Well, I think it is. It's a federal crime.
It is a federal crime.
And
right.
But this is an action that the governor has taken. As attorney general, it's my responsibility to provide advice to the governor, to his administration, and to all of the agencies. I believe the action he's taken there's ample authority for it, and it's going to be a good thing for over 200,000 Virginians who will have their voting rights restored.
If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can send a tweet at KojoShow or go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of the broadcast and join the conversation there. There's likely to be a huge pushback against this on the part of Republicans in the Commonwealth. Is there anything that the General Assembly can do at this point? The governor seems to have chosen a very strategic time at which to do this, because apparently there can't be a pushback from the General Assembly in the form of legislation at this time.
Well, the governor acted under powers granted to him by the Virginia Constitution, so it's not something that the legislature can undo. It is a power granted him under Article 5, Section 12, to restore the political rights associated that are taken away and after a felony conviction. This is really, in Virginia, a holdover from the laws designed really to disenfranchise African Americans back in the times of Jim Crow. A lot of those vestiges of the past have been removed, things like literacy tests and poll taxes. And this is one that still remains. In my view, it's one that needs to go. And this is an action that the governor has taken to help over 200,000 Virginians who right now have served their sentence, have fulfilled the terms of their supervised probation, but yet have not had their rights restored.
What do you think of the people? The criticism one will be is that the politics of this is the governor waited till after the General Assembly session, and this action could very well help the Democrats this fall when Hillary Clinton, it's expected to be the Democratic nominee, possibly Bernie Sanders, but most people now expect Hillary to be the nominee, that this was a kind of a blatant political move.
Well, we'll let the politicians say what they think about it, but I take the governor at his word that this is an action that is designed to help restore the voting rights of those who have fulfilled their sentences, served their time, and help with their reentry back into the community. One of the things that I did when I first came into office was take a look at our reentry programs. The state has some very good ones in the state prisons, but I saw that at the local level, there really wasn't a statewide effort to help the local sheriffs and the local jails in providing job training and providing connections to employment and to housing. And I also talked with a lot of folks who lost their voting rights as a result of this and have had them restored, and it means so much to them to be able to participate in democracy again and be a part of the community that they're reentering.
I have one more question on this subject. John Whitbeck, the chairman of the Republican Party from Loudoun County, I think. A lot of people from Loudoun County in here. He says that the governor could have made a distinction between violent and nonviolent criminals and felons, that he could have not given this to the violent felons who've served their time. Do you see? Obviously, you don't see that distinction.
I would like to add to that question a little bit, because I do understand about the reentry of people who have been violent felons into communities. I'm not sure I understand the distinction between nonviolent and violent felons when it comes to voting.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I think I see it, and apparently the governor as well, if someone has made a mistake, they are convicted, they are sentenced, and they fulfill their terms, they fulfill that sentence, they complete the terms of their probation, and that to me is an opportunity for a second chance after they have completed it, and it means so much to that person to be able to participate in the community, in democracy again, and not only go back and live in the community, but fully participate in it, working, living, and voting.
Mark Seagraves at Channel 4 is apparently not working and listening to this program. He just sent me a message that said there's no indication that ex-felons register as Democrats more so than Republicans. Are you aware of any
stats? Get a job, Seagraves, but go ahead.
Well, I'm not aware of any studies. Maybe there's some out there.
Yeah,
this ought to be a nonpartisan issue, and I think Governor McDonald's action, you know, a few years ago in advocating for and supporting automatic restoration of rights is an indication of that, and it should be a nonpartisan issue.
One of the bigger news stories in Virginia, the death penalty and recent wrangling over carrying out executions. The General Assembly wanted to make the electric chair the default method because of the scarcity of lethal injection drugs. Governor McAuliffe countered with a plan to keep secret the names of pharmacies supplying lethal injection drugs. You issued an opinion earlier this week deeming it legal to keep those drug company names from being made public. The General Assembly then passed the bill. What were the legal issues around this?
Well, first of all, whether it's the legislature or the governor who is called upon to work with corrections to carry out a sentence like that. Those are, you know, the death penalty, carrying out that sentence is probably one of the most solemn and consequential acts that a state can exercise. And so it's one that needs to be approached in a very thoughtful, careful manner. When the governor announced those changes or proposed changes in the form of amendments, a few legislators asked some legal questions about whether the proposals were constitutional, whether there were any federal laws that conflicted with it. For example, whether some of the federal drug administration regulations or laws were impacted by it. So my role as attorney general there was not to make a decision or cast a vote one way or the other. That's a policy question for the legislature and for the governor to grapple with. But as the attorney general, it was to help provide them all of the legal information that they need as they deliberated the governor's proposed amendments. One of the more controversial ones was the secrecy of the identity of the drug makers. And I think that was one of the questions that was raised. It was important for folks to realize that it doesn't shield information about what the drugs are that are being used or what the protocols are that are being used, but rather the identity of the maker of the drug. And even then, the governor's amendments provide for a process where an inmate could ask a court for that information by demonstrating good cause.
Would you ban the death penalty if it were in your power?
Well, I have, as a state legislator, had to cast votes on this. I do think, just for me personally, every legislator has to approach it in a very careful and thoughtful way. No matter which way you come down on it, that your heart and your conscience tell you, I respect that viewpoint. I personally believe it should continue to be an option for those most heinous crimes that we have, and that we hold prosecutors to the very highest standards when they ask for that, and that we work extra hard to make sure that it's being applied in a non-discriminatory manner.
Can we ask about it? Well, you are the attorney general. There's another legal case in the Fourth Circuit that in Gloucester. Is it Gloucester?
Coming out of Gloucester, Virginia.
Gloucester. Yeah, is Gloucester it Gloucester? County. I always mispronounce that one. Okay, I'm glad I'm not there. I apologize. The suit of the transgender person who wants to use the public restroom, bathroom of their gender identity. And the court, where are we on that?
Yeah. Well, this is the Grimm case out of...
Gavin Grimm.
Right. A transgender teen in Gloucester County wanted to use the facilities at school that correspond to the gender he identifies with.
The boys' bathroom.
Right. And the school board adopted a policy that prohibited that. He filed suit in federal court. The court dismissed the case very quickly at a very preliminary stage. It was then appealed to the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit a few days ago reversed that and actually didn't decide the case, but remanded it because there were interpretations that the Department of Education had issued indicating that gender identity could be considered discrimination under certain circumstances, and that the court set it back to the trial court for further proceedings consistent with that ruling and a correct interpretation of the law. My understanding is that Gloucester County may intend to ask for a rehearing in front of the full Fourth Circuit. There was a panel of the Fourth Circuit that heard it, three members of the Fourth Circuit.
Two to one split.
Right.
Well, the case doesn't directly involve your office, but a Republican lawmaker is suing you for failing to provide him with legal guidance on this issue. He said he asked for your opinion. He still hasn't gotten it. Are you going to weigh in and provide clarity for that particular Republican member?
That's David LaRocque of Loudoun County.
He wants
you to define
it's
sex.
It's all Loudoun all the time. Yeah, he wants me to define sex. First of all, I want to say that I think the lawsuit is silly. It's ridiculous. And we had sent a message to Delegate LaRocque, told him we were in the process of responding. And there are a lot of cases that are currently pending in courts, not only in Virginia, but across the country. The law is changing and developing, and my first responsibility when asked for official legal opinions is to make sure I get them right. And I don't want to do that ill-advisedly. And so,
you're not holding this one up because you don't want to give him that definition?
No, not at all.
That's the implication of his complaint.
Well, as I said, it's a ridiculous complaint and a silly lawsuit. And you know, he and some others in the state legislature want to turn the clock back when it comes to discrimination. And what I would tell Delegate LaRock and others who want to go back to allowing discrimination is that they should get to know some of the folks who are hurt by that. And even if they're indifferent to how those folks feel, then just take a look at what some of our sister states are facing, because not only is it wrong from, in my view, a moral perspective, but it's also very bad for business. And you take a look at what's happening in North Carolina with the law that the governor signed, you've got large companies threatening to pull out, and it has economic consequences as well.
Sexual assault on college campuses has been a very big issue nationally, also particularly in Virginia. After the discovery of thousands of untested rape kits last year, Virginia has taken steps to address the problem, including legislation just signed into law with new rules around testing those kits, as well as a grant that you secured to help clear the backlog. How important is that?
Oh, it is hugely important for the state to be able to bring to justice those who have committed serious crimes. But it also means so much to survivors of sexual violence. A couple of years ago, when we began our work addressing the problem of sexual assaults on college campuses, we made a number of recommendations. There were 21 of them. In fact, I remember Jen was here, I think, last year, shortly after we announced that, and we had a great conversation about it because she does a lot of good work over in Maryland. And among those recommendations include things like directing the Department of Criminal Justice Services to offer trauma-informed training to those who investigate sexual assault cases. And that was one of the laws that the governor signed this year. And another piece of it is to make sure that the PERT kits, the rape test kits, are all tested going forward. That is so important because we know that sexual violence oftentimes is a serial crime. These perpetrators oftentimes commit more than one. And so it's an important way of making sure that we can link known perpetrators to other crimes. It's a way to identify perpetrators in crimes. And when I heard about the backlog, 2,000 kits remained untested going back as long as 1988. I knew something had to be done, applied for a grant. We got $1.4 million to test all the back kits. The kits from Fairfax County and Virginia Beach are being tested right now. Others from other localities around the state will quickly follow.
Go ahead. We only have about 2 minutes left.
Oh, my question is going to take that long. Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia, gave a speech to the Hispanic and African American Publishers Association recently, and he characterized a lot of things we're discussing here and discussed here today, all these social issues, sexual identity and sexual rights, immigration. He says that he sees a country where many white people in this country we're having a generational change where young people coming along, don't hold the same prejudices and views of the older people, where the country is getting more diverse with Hispanics. And he says that there's a lot of fear in the sense of the white community, that people need to be reassured that while they may be losing their majority status, that they're still part of this changing country. Is that, do you recognize that?
You know, those are some interesting observations. Senator Kaine is a very insightful, thoughtful man and with a great heart. And as I look at some of these same kinds of issues of diversity, I do see the diversity is really a strength. It's a real asset for us. When I grew up in Loudoun County, you know, we've been talking a lot about the politics of Loudoun County, but
It was rural.
It was very rural back in the 70s. And now we've got, I think the population is probably pushing 350,000. Yeah. In the Senate district I represented back when I was in the Senate in the 2010 census, it was 20% Asian, 18.5% Latino or Hispanic, 13.5% African American. If you add it up, it's a majority-minority. If you would have said the senior senator from Loudoun, you know, 30 years ago was representing a majority-minority district, people would have never believed that that would happen. And I've had a front-row seat to that kind of dynamic community, and I have seen that it is a real strength and an asset. And I see those same changes happening throughout Virginia. I think that's a good thing. I think it positions us well going into the future, and we need to work to integrate all the minority communities we have.
Just about out of time, I just wanted to read an email we got from Bennett in Arlington, who says, somehow we came to accept that felons should be denied the right to vote. This history of the denial of voting rights gained steam after the Civil War to deny the suffrage to freed slaves. Denial of voting rights has been wrapped in civil rights for minorities ever since. It's our default, except in the two states that don't take away the right to vote upon felony conviction, Maine and Vermont. Not coincidentally, they are two of our whitest states. And in an article this morning in the New York Times about the governor's action, it says that Virginia's constitution has prohibited felons from voting since the Civil War. The restrictions were expanded in 1982. In researching the provisions, advisors to Governor McAuliffe turned up a 1906 report quoting Carter Glass, a Virginia state senator, as saying that these provisions, quote unquote, would eliminate the darkey as a political factor in this state in less than 5 years, so that no single county of the Commonwealth will there be at least the least concern felt for the complete supremacy of the white race in the affairs of government. That's the history.
That's the history, and it is another reason why we need to get rid of all of the last vestiges of these laws, because the Virginia I know is one that truly is an open and welcoming and inclusive state for everyone that believes in equality. That's the Virginia vision that I know and the Virginia that I'm fighting for.
There's a lot going on. Are you still comfortable with your decision not to run for governor and let Ralph Northam be the Democratic nominee?
You know, Ralph Northam is going to be a great governor. I love
you're going to run for re-election.
I am running for re-election, and I love the job and would like to have the opportunity to continue doing it.
Mark Herring, he is Virginia's Attorney General. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's great to be back on the show.
It's the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Kathleen Dumais. She is a member of Maryland's House of Delegates, a Democrat representing District 15. But in the meantime, Tom Sherwood, the D.C. Council has decided that there should be a permanent ban on marijuana clubs in the District of Columbia and voted to do so last week. Yesterday, we had some advocates for marijuana on the show who said they consider that a setback. Why did the council vote this
way? First of all, it's about as permanent as ice in July. The council members, the majority of them would like to regulate and tax the sale and purchase of marijuana in the District of Columbia, just like Colorado. But because Congress has interfered with the city's local laws and has prohibited the city from making any rules or regulations or tax policies, the mayor was concerned that, and some of the council members obviously were concerned, that if you allow, go beyond what the initiative did, which is allow private consumption in your home, and if you went to private clubs, the police would be unable to regulate them. There'd be no, like, alcohol regulation. There would be no regulations. It would be kind of a wild west of pot smoking in the city. And they said that the police and other people couldn't have that. So the council has reluctantly put off any private club smoking. There is a task force that will be spending the next 4 months. Brianne Nadeau, the Ward 1 council member, will be doing that. There's a meeting, I think, tonight. And they're going to try to figure out what they can do going forward. But Congress is a big roadblock.
A wild west of pot smoking in the district.
Well, you know, they try to wrap it in Colorado, you know, in Washington State.
Well, joining us in studio is Kathleen Dumais. She's a member of the Maryland's House of Delegates. She's a Democrat representing District 15. Thank you very much for joining us, Delegate Dumais.
Thank you for having me.
Just been reading that PEPCO is going to be raising rates in the state of Maryland by around 10%, reported in the DCS. The increase is the equivalent of about $15.80 per month, according to the company, which says the average monthly bill stands at $152. As you know, because of the merger between PEPCO and Exelon, there's a great fear that the same thing is about to happen in the District of Columbia. It's already happening in Maryland.
It is happening in Maryland, and we'll have to see what the Public Service Commission does with reference to the request. And
Has the Public Service Commission ever blocked an increase or just minimized it?
They usually just minimize it. They don't block it, but we can always hope, and I do think that the merger was sort of billed as something that was going to save people money. So I do think that the Public Service Commission will take a pretty strong look at it.
If you have comments or questions for Delegate Dumais, you can call us at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. The legislative session that just wrapped up was characterized as much by what it did not pass as by what it did. You're vice chair of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. I should say Senator Dumais.
No, and you're right. I'm in the House.
You're in the House?
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. And you co-sponsored a bill that would have terminated the parental rights of rapists. It had wide support and made it farther than it had since it was first introduced 9 years ago.
That's correct.
But it died in the final hours of the legislative session last week. What happened?
Well, first, it is the first time that the House Judiciary Committee actually voted on the bill. And I have sponsored it, and we usually have at least 72 sponsors. This year we had 78 in the House of Delegates. And it's there are 30 states that, actually 32 states that have a law that would allow the termination of parental rights if a child was conceived without consent. The controversy has always been, do you need a conviction? Because obviously termination of parental rights is a civil proceeding. And my bill does not. Of the 32 states, 12 states do not require conviction. But this year we convinced the chairman that he needed to vote the bill. Then it went to the Senate, where it has passed at least three different times. But that was when Brian Frosch was the chair. And this year it just... First they amended the bill ridiculously and really massacred it. And then...
That's the word you use, massacred, but... What if you? I looked over. I read a lot of this. I was looking for what is the opposition to this. It's not clear in any of the stories. And then people can add poison pills to bills to something that will
right,
get people to vote against them.
Story,
but in the simplest, single, direct sentences possible, why are people opposed to having a law that says if you're the victim of a rape, the rapist cannot have any parental rights? It seems almost
so that it fails sense. To pass nine times.
Right. Is, can you, in the simplest sentence?
I can. And it's that they are concerned that it would be misused, that in a family law case, that women in particular, but it's not necessarily just women, would use it to deny someone access to a child in a vindictive manner and would get on the stand and, you know, sort of make up a story of rape. We see this so many times when we put in domestic violence bills and, you know, the, as well as this one.
Yeah, do you believe that is the reason? Is there, I mean, that sounds like a kind of a weak read. Is that the reason or is that the public reason and there's something more behind it? Is it
no,
sex
I think,
discrimination?
Yes. I think the real reason is people that don't practice in the family law area don't understand what the judges have to consider. And there's just this fear that somehow, you know, the right to be a parent is very important, which I don't deny. And that, you know, somehow this is a cheap or an escape route to get someone out of a child's life.
Underscoring that is that another bill was an attempt to expand domestic violence protection. Mm-hmm. It never made it out of the House committee, but its sponsor, Delegate Angela Angel, right, made a move to attach it to another bill, a procedural move which angered some colleagues and ultimately failed. As Judiciary Proceedings Vice Chair, you tried to stop the move. What was the problem?
Actually, the House Judiciary Committee did vote on her bill, and we had given it an unfavorable. And I've talked to Delegate Angel, and I don't know if it would. I practice in the area of family law. I handle domestic violence cases. I've put in a lot of legislation in the area of domestic violence. What her bill purported to do was to add harassment and malicious destruction of property to the list of what would be abuse that you could then get a protective order for. And as I told her, I've done a similar bill in the past that we weren't able to get through. And I think properly, stalking is considered abuse under the domestic violence statute. And it's very clearly defined. Harassment is less than that. But the relief that is available under our domestic violence laws is really important and strong. You can kick someone out of their house up to a year or two. You can deny them contact with children. And these cases come up, you know, very quickly and are given, you know, maybe 10 minutes. And just saying someone was harassing me, the committee hasn't felt rose to the level of something that would be abuse under the domestic violence statute.
Cyberbullying wouldn't be abuse?
Cyberbullying actually would fall under, could fall under stalking under Maryland law, which is considered abuse.
Put on your headphones, Tom, because we're about to hear from Diana in Potomac, Maryland. Diana, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm Diana. I am in Potomac. I used to be in Kathleen's district, and they redrew the line, so I'm next door, but still a fan.
Thank you, Diana.
She's not paying me for this, but she is honestly one of the people who has dragged Maryland's family law into this century. And a lot of us who don't even have family law issues per se are glad to see it. I was particularly upset this session to find out that the chairman who has stopped it in the past is the one who once again stopped the legislation on the rapist, quote, parental rights. I mean, do you think the person who's perpetrating a rape really thinks, boy, I hope I get access to this kid?
No.
It's really just stunning. And the chair of the committee has done this year after year. And what I want to know is how come the leadership in the House isn't kicking that guy off? He's a troglodyte. I mean,
who are we talking about, just to be clear? Is this
my kid? Chairman, Chairman Valerio.
Valerio, okay.
Right.
And where is he from?
He is from Prince George's County. Okay. And he has been chair of the House Judiciary Committee since 1993, I believe. And I will tell you, for what it's worth, and I've had this conversation with Diana, I get along with him incredibly well, and I think the two of us make a good team. We do have our disagreements. This bill is one, and we've had some pretty
strong ones. Well, is it possible to craft a measure that would deny parental rights to a rapist while at the same time not allowing it to be used in cases of domestic disputes?
And I think we have. Now, in fairness, over the last 9 years, we have made multiple changes responding to concerns, you know, is there enough due process protection? And there should be. And I think we now have it right. And in fact, some of the amendments that were put on by the Senate that were, they stripped amendments that we felt protected victims. They put on amendments that would be more protective of the respondent. The bill next year will include many of the protections they wanted for the respondents. For instance, that any testimony in the civil case cannot be used against them, or that cannot be used in the criminal case. So legislation, as I know you know, goes through lots of different paths, and sometimes the process improves the bill. I think we will probably get it done next year.
Did you say that last year?
I probably said it every year, to be honest. But I do think making it through the House was the major piece. I mean, Senator Jamie Raskin has always been the sponsor in the Senate. 3 times the Senate passed it, and he came over to the House and then was very disappointed. And then it was, okay, let's let the House move it. The House has moved it. It's in a good posture, and I think that we'll be able to pull it through next year.
Well, speaking of Jamie Raskin, who's running for Congress in
the
8th
Maryland
District.
Are you hoping to lose him in the Senate?
Have you endorsed anyone in that race, Kathleen Matthews and David Trone?
I actually endorsed Jamie early on. I've worked with him for, you know, 12 years, and I think that he would be – it's his passion and the grassroots, the way he connects with people. He's a skillful legislator.
That's enough about Jamie.
Okay.
The primary is Tuesday.
Correct.
Have you voted early by chance?
A lot of
early voting, and a lot of it in Silver Spring, too.
Now,
where are you in the Senate race between Donna Edwards and Chris Van Hollen?
With Chris Van Hollen. I just think, again, his ability to reach across the aisle and to see the big picture and get things done is really what's going to be important for us in the Senate.
Okay, and finally, in the presidential campaign, are you for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or write in somebody else?
I'm for Hillary Clinton and did vote for her.
There you go.
You've been on the task force to combat driving under the influence in the past. Mm-hmm. A few alcohol-related bills came up this session, including the Alex and Calvin bill related to underage drinking. That bill also had major amendments added in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. Talk about what that bill would do.
Sure. Currently, under Maryland law, if you provide alcohol knowingly to underage drinkers in your home, there's a fine.
Just a fine?
Just a fine.
Whoa. I didn't know that.
Yes, just a fine. And so what the bill did as introduced was indicate that it just added the possibility that the court could order incarceration of up to 1 year for the first offense, up to 2 years for the second offense. The accident where Alex Merck and Calvin Lee were killed was less than 2 miles from my house. It's an absolutely horrible scene, and the parents were the ones that came and testified. And I don't think we hear a lot of very impassioned testimony. This was really incredible. It was so incredible and so heart-wrenching that when we had the bill in the Senate and the House the same day, and in the Senate, after the testimony of the parents, before all of the rest of the testimony was done, Senator Zirkin said, let's move favorable, and voted the bill, which was the Senate bill. Then we didn't vote it right away, but we voted it. We made one modification so that I won't too detailed, but one slight modification, but left it pretty much the way it had come in. And then the last week of session, Senator Zirkin modified the House bill to say the incarceration only would apply if someone knowingly gave someone alcohol, knew they were going to get in their car, and that once they were in their car, there was, in fact, an accident.
A lot of loopholes.
So my committee has vowed that we will fix that next year.
In this session, lawmakers also passed what's been described as a landmark criminal justice reform bill, including rolling back mandatory minimum sentences and holding, quote unquote, bad cops accountable. How far do these reforms really go in addressing the issues that came to a boil with the death of Freddie Gray and the riots in Baltimore that followed?
Well, I'll talk first a little bit about the Justice Reinvestment Act, which is the criminal justice reform. And this is a U.S. Department of Justice program. 30 other states have already done it. The idea being that truly, if you can reduce the number of prison beds at the same time making sure the public is safe, and you save money, you then reinvest it in mental health treatment, alcohol and substance abuse treatment, reentry programs, which I know you were just speaking with the Attorney General from Virginia. Mm-hmm. So that it's really important that how do we reduce recidivism, and particularly for nonviolent offenders.
We're talking about unclogging the prisons with mm-hmm. nonviolent offenders. How many people are we talking about?
We think that we can reduce, with all of the different things that we are included in the bill, we're hoping to reduce the prison population over the next 10 years by 3,500 to 4,000, which means we currently have in the state prison about 22,000, and this would bring it down to somewhere in the 17, 16.
Okay. Well, I want to ask, I read the story the Washington Post, Robin Wiener, did on Van Hollen this morning. I got mm-hmm. all the way to the end, and I discovered that he likes to fish and he likes to ride bicycles.
Hmm.
So in doing my research about you and all these great things that you're, and I say great, not that I'm endorsing them, but just that you're very active in so many issues that affect the mm-hmm. lives of people in the state of Maryland, I didn't find anything where you did something for fun. Do you fish or bike?
I've been told that before.
Her day job is fun. She's a lawyer.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, listen, it's fun being a lawyer. I'm sure, although I would never want to try. But for people who don't know you, I had to read a lot about you. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you're from the western part of the county, of Montgomery County. Just tell us something about who you are.
So I think that I define myself a great deal by my family. I am the oldest of 8 children. I have 22 nieces and nephews, so when you want to know what I do for fun,
exactly right.
Yeah, buy presents, but I tend to be the favorite aunt. I love to have them to my house for a weekend.
Are they all around here, or just out in California where you're from?
We are very lucky that they're all here, and the irony when you say California, I was born in La Jolla, California, but it was because my father was in the Marines and stationed at Pendleton at the time. When I was 6 weeks old, we moved to Maryland because he got a job as he got out of the Marines as a Montgomery County school teacher. And so we lived in Prince George's. Dad worked in Montgomery. I now live in Montgomery my entire life.
Okay, so the California's a footnote or an asterisk.
It's a tiny little asterisk. That's exactly right.
Are you going to run for any other offices?
I actually really enjoy being in the House.
Oh, everyone says that's the answer everyone gives.
But here's the reason why, and something else. When I was in high school, I was a page. When I was a senior in the Maryland House of Delegates, and I got the bug then and thought at some point, if my career allowed, I wanted to be there, because what we do in the state legislature is we really work on things that affects everybody's everyday life. I mean, I practice family law, so mm-hmm. the differences that I've been able to make in sort of custody and domestic violence and marital property distribution, you know, those are the things that are tangible.
Well, here's what Tom does with his weekends. He gets on his bicycle, he rides downtown, checks on traffic, apparently tries to direct traffic, and then writes columns in the current newspaper berating the government for not doing enough of that traffic
downtown.
I've seen
some of those.
Well, that's what he does.
It's a crime.
He has no life, okay?
That's an outrage that our city is growing and we're getting Manhattan-style traffic downtown without one traffic
control. The man's got way too much time
on
his hands. Kathleen Dumais is a member of the Maryland House of Delegates. She's a Democrat representing District 15. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And then we'll get to discussing exactly what's going on in a number of high-profile Maryland races. But there was something else I wanted to ask you about, Tom Sherwood, before we got to that.
Minimum wage in D.C.?
Minimum wage in D.C., and it's going to include tipped wages. Go ahead. Let's talk about
that. The summary of that really quickly is
go ahead.
Mayor Bowser has now proposed that there be a $15 an hour minimum wage by 2020. It's going to $11.50 this July. That's a significant increase. People may remember the council was people tried to get the council to impose that wage on the Walmart, and it didn't pass. But also tip workers who only make $2.77 an hour now
be included.
They would go up to $7.50, which is about half, and as of 2022, and then they would always stay at half of what the minimum wage is. A lot of nightclubs and restaurant people don't like that, according to their association, saying that it's going to raise the cost of hiring people and could cost jobs. But the fact is, across this country, the minimum wage is going up, and the federal wage at $7.25 at some point, probably next year, would go up also.
And if you want to live in this city where the cost of living and the cost of housing seems to be going up all the time, it's kind of tough.
Income inequality is one of the biggest issues in the nation.
Joining us by phone from Baltimore now is John Fritzy. He's the reporter with the Baltimore Sun covering Maryland politics. John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Number of high-profile Maryland races, starting with the Senate race to replace Senator Barbara Mikulski. The Democrats in that hard-fought race, two members of Congress, Donna Edwards and Chris Van Hollen, it's been close. Just a few weeks ago, Edwards had a 4-point lead. Most recent polls, Van Hollen has anywhere between a 6 and 16-point lead. Correct me if I'm wrong. So talk about that and what stands out to you about that race.
I mean, it's such a great race. I feel like for so many years we haven't had great statewide politics, and this year we obviously do. This Senate race is kind of a marquee race. Yeah, I mean, look, it's been close for a long time. There is a number of polls out in the last couple of weeks that have shown Van Hollen with a little bit of an increase, and then there was big one yesterday that had him up 16 points. And I talked to the pollster a little bit about that poll, and he said that not only was Van Hollen not big, but that he was going up every day they were polling. In other words, every day they were in the field, the data they got back, he was doing a little bit better every day. And that would suggest that, you know, maybe there's some momentum for Van Hollen. Countering that, yesterday, hours after that poll came out, Emily's List, the group that has long supported Donna Edwards, said it is going to get back in with about $500,000 in advertising in both Baltimore and the Washington market. So we'll see what kind of impact that has.
John, Tom Sherwood here. If without Emily's List, which has spent, this will be now, what, $2.5 million or so they've spent, Don Edwards has been woefully behind in raising money herself. Without the independent PACs, she'd be in a difficult place even to make a race, wouldn't she?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, $2.5 million plus another $500,000 that was funneled through this other super PAC. That's absolutely right. I mean, look, she was never going to be as competitive with him in fundraising. She had a pretty good first quarter this year. She hit the million mark for the first time. But, you know, she is still a far, far less of a fundraiser than he is, Van Hollen being a former DCCC chairman and so forth.
Yeah, he knows how to raise money. But let me ask you about the independent PAC that does support her and put out that ad, I think Works for Us, that slammed Van Hollen on guns and issues and tried to drag Obama into it. That seemed to be kind of a turning point in the campaign, the blowback on that.
Yeah, there was blowback. I mean, I think the most significant thing was the White House weighing in, right? So the White House political director, David Simas, weighs in and sort of says, look, that's too far. Now, I think there's interpretation of what exactly the White House is objecting to. One interpretation is that the White House was very specifically concerned about the use of Obama's image in that ad and felt like that was inaccurate. Another interpretation is that the White House doesn't jump into a race like that without understanding the political consequences and significance. White House hardly ever jumps into a race at all. The fact that they spoke up, a lot of people are taking as sort of a sign that they didn't, they don't like that message at all. And so
it was a tilt to Van Hollen, wasn't it? By objecting to the ad.
I think that some people would say that, hey, you don't shout down somebody if you want them to win. And so I think that is a very fine argument. The White House statement was very limited to this super PAC, but Edwards has been raising a very similar message in her own advertising. Yeah, I think, if Van Hollen wins this thing, that is a weak, that particular moment when the White House weighed in, I think is something we're going to look at as a potential turning point. We'll just have to see how much impact that really has.
I'm going to be at her headquarters election night, so I'm anxious to see what happens.
There's not much coverage of the Republicans running in this race. However, a number of Republican candidates are hoping to piggyback off the popularity of Governor Larry Hogan. That apparently means running a certain kind of race, one that does not emphasize social issues. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that's generally right. I mean, there's a bunch of candidates, 14 candidates running for the Republican nomination, most of whom no one's ever heard of before.
How many?
14. and we've got I think probably the best known is a state delegate from up our way, Baltimore County. She's the minority whip in the House of Delegates in Annapolis. And so she has some name recognition, sort of has the...
Who is it?
Kathy Shalega, Delegate Kathy Shalega. Institutional support is kind of a bad word these days in Republican circles, but that's kind of who she is. She has the establishment sort of support, a lot of well-known Republicans backing her. The other guy that's getting some attention is a guy named Chris Kafalas, also a Baltimore, although he spent some time in Washington as well. He's an interesting guy, openly gay Republican, worked for both Obama administration and Bob Ehrlich administration. So he has sort of straddled a bunch of different lines. It could make him interesting in a general, but, neither one of these candidates are raising a ton of money.
Is Hogan getting involved in any way, either directly or subtly?
Noticeably silent.
The 8th District race, 9 candidates, record-breaking money spent. Talk about the front runners, and what's your take on that race?
I mean, the 8th District is a great race. I think it's one of the best House races in the country.
It's certainly the most expensive.
Without a doubt.
That's right, that's right. And, of course, that is, as you guys know, that's largely driven by David Trone, businessman, owner of Total Wine and More, who is self-funding his campaign and has put in more than $12 million of his own money. He's ubiquitous.
Is it working?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I think he certainly has to be taken seriously. You also have two probably better known people in Jamie Raskin, state senator, has appealed to, sort of very progressive groups, is pretty well known. And then Kathleen Matthews, the former WJLA anchor, also very well known. And both of those guys, those three candidates, have spent a good deal of money as well. And so I think all three of those you have to take pretty seriously. The great thing about it is that they're all relatively new people. Whoever emerges from that race is sort of instantaneously, I think, an important person in Maryland politics just because of where that district is and because of the fundraising that comes out of it. I think it'll be fascinating. No matter who wins, it'll be a person to watch.
4th District race, former Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, former Prince George's State's Attorney Glenn Ivey, and Delegate Josephine Peña Melnick, front runners, I guess, in that race. What's your take?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've been a little disappointed by is that race hasn't received as much attention as the neighboring district. And that's been the case all along. The 8th District, they were doing forum after forum, and the 4th District got started a lot later on in the process. District includes Prince George's County, and a little bit of Anne Arundel County. Yeah, I mean, Anthony Brown is certainly the guy that everybody knows because he was the former lieutenant governor. He struggled to raise money a little bit throughout this election. In fact, this most recent report, he loaned himself $500,000. And that's kind of an issue for him because he still has an outstanding loan from his gubernatorial campaign, his unsuccessful campaign.
That's what people know about him. Even though he's a very well-liked person, politically, that loss to Larry Hogan was just devastating for him, and he's had a hard time coming back from that, just politically speaking.
I think that's absolutely right. I think a lot of Democrats are a little wary, and I think that's part of I think that's partly reflected in the fundraising. I think it's been hard for him to raise money because people say, well, hey,
You had your shot.
Money for governors.
Right. You had your shot.
Right. So that's been his biggest challenge, I think. You know, Glenn Ivey, very well known. He started to run ads sort of talking about his former work as the state's attorney and some of the crime efforts that he pursued. And then Jocelyn Peña-Melnick, a state delegate, you know, what everybody said about her at the start of this race is how hard she works. And I think that is totally borne out. She's raised, I think, as much, if not a little bit more, than Anthony Brown, a former. She's raised a lot of money. She's been very aggressive, picked up a lot of important endorsements, including from groups like Emily's List. She's worked really hard.
Got less than a minute left. Tuesday's primary day for the presidential candidates. Donald Trump held his first rally. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are leading. Any surprises that may occur there?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, Sanders is actually coming into Baltimore. We just learned a few minutes ago, so he'll be making his first appearance. The real action there is on the Republican side, I think, and whether a guy like Kasich or Cruz can pull a few delegates away from Donald Trump. Maryland allocates by congressional district. There's an opportunity for them, even if Trump wins statewide, to withhold a few delegates from Donald Trump.
John Fritzy, he's a reporter with the Baltimore Sun covering Maryland politics. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's like a lightning round.
That's it for the show today as we wrap up for the week. But before we go, remember we've got lots more for you online. After yesterday's show about Jedge, I was inspired to share my thoughts on one of the city's best-kept secrets on that front, the UDC Big Band Jazz Festival, and it's coming up next Monday, the 25th. Read more about it by heading to kojoshow.org/blog. While you're there, check out our archives for lots more, including a peek into the real-life backdrop for the PBS drama Mercy Street, which just started filming season 2, and a look at a recently revived historic DC lager that might factor into your weekend plans. Have a great weekend. Be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. We consider what happens when a once wealthy suburb tightens its belt as Fairfax County demographics shift from white and wealthy to diverse and older, revenues beginning to fall short for parks, roads, and schools, plus the buzz about our region's bees. We hear from local experts on efforts to save Maryland's pollinators. That's all coming up Monday at noon. Tom Sherwood, always a pleasure.
Play some Prince this weekend.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Nandi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.